Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Can a band be bigger than its largest audience? Can its name live past any hummable tune? And can its legacy, its legend and influence expand beyond its lifespan without any drug overdoses or suicide leering on the way? Well, Fifth Column, the legendary underground Toronto all-female post-punk band, lives up to all that, and it's the subject of a new documentary called She Said Boom, the story of Fifth Column, playing at Toronto's Inside Out Film Festival on Sunday. And I have the film's director, Kevin Hagee, here in the studio with me. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
So, let's start. What year were you born?
1979.
1979. So you actually do, I was going to say the band predates you, but you probably were born a little before it started. What year did the band start?
Officially 1981, so I just made it.
So basically you're the same age as the band.
Yeah, basically.
So have you lived with it all your life, or when did you first hear about it?
The music, actually, I heard after sort of later into my knowledge of individual members' artworks. I was working at a record store, but I was a fan of GB Jones's artwork, and I was also familiar with the zine JD's, which she did with Bruce LaBruce, another sort of infamous Canadian filmmaker. And then I had a roommate a couple years after I graduated from college, and she was a big record collector also, and she had all the Fifth Column records. And so, you know, I knew a few songs, and she had all of the records. So she played me to Sir With Hate, the first record. And
so you knew the music before you met the members in the group?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And what propelled you to make a film about this?
Well, I mean, it got to the point where I eventually met certain people from the story individually. I met Caroline Azar, the lead singer, because she sort of randomly came into the record store looking for Brigitte Bardot records. Yeah, and I actually didn't know it was her until my boss was like, I was kind of fawning over her just because she seemed really glamorous. I didn't even know that she was the singer from Fifth Column, and later found that out. And I knew GB Jones as an acquaintance through the art world, the Queen West sort of queer art scene. And Bruce LaBruce, who was their go-go dancer, was a close friend of mine, so he would always sort of tell me stories and inspire me to sort of look at those histories more closely. And eventually, I just decided to try and... These people were all estranged to each other, so I thought maybe I could apply my interest in art and music and my background in film to try and look at the history more closely.
Yeah, I noticed that there's no scene in your film, which, like a contemporary scene, that has any two of the people in the same frame at the same time. Was that your aim, or the people not wanting to be around each other?
It wasn't so much people didn't want to be around each other, it's just that they weren't around each other, and certain people hadn't spoken to one another for a long time, and I spent a lot of time just sort of trying to warm up to a lot of these people, because it was kind of a shock for them to have somebody just show up and be like, I want to, you know, make a movie about your life's work or this part of your career. So I guess just because of trying to create those relationships, it just felt really one-on-one and direct for me. And the way I imagined the individual scenarios were like caricatures or cartoony settings for my sort of impression of their character, not knowing them too intimately, you know? So I kind of projected all of these spaces that that you see them in the film. So.
This is CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm speaking with Kevin Hagee about his new film called She Said Boom. So what does the film have to say about the dawn? Well, first, can you define homocore or queercore?
Well, queercore was a reaction that GB Jones and Bruce LaBruce had to the homophobia in the punk scene. You know, they were making films, and they were making zines, and they were part of the sort of Toronto punk scene, but of course never really fit in. They were just sort of out of place in the mainstream queer or gay scene and the underground punk scene, so there wasn't really anywhere for them to go. But basically after encountering this homophobia, they got really pissed off about it and went and wrote a manifesto, a sort of infamous manifesto.
Which was published in the zine?
Yeah, and I think initially it was sent to Maximum Rock and Roll, the sort of punk rock Bible zine, you know. And from out of that, I think G.B. Jones made a tape called the Homocore Mixtape and sent it around with her zine. And then, like she explains in the movie, Homocore, all these guys just thought it was about men, like gay men. So she kind of reclaimed the word queer, which at the time was pretty derogatory.
That's right.
And changed it to queercore so that it could sort of represent gender beyond label. And so out of that spread this sort of culture, the subculture, just sort of sprung out of that initiative.
And for many people, as you show in the movie, it's thought of as a Toronto-spawned phenomenon. But was it the phenomenon that people thought of it?
Well, I mean, yeah, a lot of it was based on lies. Like, they sort of, there was just sort of a few little nerdy punk people, you know, and they just sort of, in the zine, they sort of fabricated this tale that Toronto was this punk rock utopia for queer punk rockers. And there really wasn't that scene at all. It was just a few people hanging out. But when they mailed these stories to different cities in North America, people had no reason to not believe it. So they started forming those communities in their own cities. And, you know, people would want to come to Toronto, and they imagined it to be this, you know, queer punk heaven, and it wasn't the case at all. It was just as nightmarish and, you know, straight boy hardcore as any other city.
But Fifth Column had sort of it was even legendary in its own time. I mean, more people knew about it than had ever actually seen them anywhere. They didn't play that often, but they had spray-painted stencil graffiti all around the city with their name or their symbol on it, and little photocopied posters on walls, and people would talk about it, but people would say things like, oh, they might say, don't go there, it's dangerous, or they don't like guys, or this sort of thing. Did you ever see them live, I should say?
No, absolutely not. No, I wish.
But you heard their recorded music. How would you describe their music? I mean, it's called post-punk, but it sounds sort of like, sometimes like Joy Division, sometimes like pop music from the 60s. So how would you define it?
Well, I mean, post-punk just means sort of the space where you can reimagine what it means to be in a band, you know, and that's the Fifth Column we're doing. So all that propaganda, all of the mystery around their identities and everything was all part of that, you know, beyond the music. And so they didn't really know how to play music. It was just an extension of this idea of imagining performance and what that meant. And so initially, I mean, the first record's my favorite because it's this murky sort of psychedelic music, you know? It's really strange. And later, I think they fine-tuned their interests in the sort of 60s psychedelic pop music and even surf music. So that cacophony and that sort of interest in those old types of music sort of came together, but still with this really strange, unique narrative style.
And is the music itself, it seems to nowadays be completely, it seems to have been made on obsolete formats like cassette tapes and paper zines and spray paint and Super 8 film. Does that add to its authenticity or make it seem like an obsolete relic?
Well, I mean, making records at the time, I think, was a real pain in the ass. Like, you know, you had to spend the money to go somewhere, to spend the time with someone who could help you record it. And, you know, you had to get the money together yourself, especially, like, if Fifth Column were always working outside of capitalist means. So, you know, they weren't going to sign a record deal and take the easiest road to getting that done. So the pain of the process part of the beauty of the way Fifth Column worked, with the films and with the records and everything and the zines. So I think it's a little of both, you know. In a way, I imagine all of this, I didn't realize it until I finished the movie, that this is all sort of like a seed or like a an early imagining of the way that bands do things now, where there's so much exposure on the internet that you actually have to do more. You have to create this image. You have to have an entire package to get noticed. And yeah, you can record it all yourself. There's actually a sort of new DIY that's helping bands, you know,
record and mix,
record and get heard and everything. So they're actually doing things easier now, but the way that Fifth Column would do it back then, like, yeah, we're not going to just wait to get a record label and play live and do all this drudgery. We're just going to sort of record it ourselves, make our own images, make our own, you know, movies, and construct this entire project around this music.
And the movies that you showed in your film, were they all the original Super 8, or did you do some new footage yourself? There's some core stuff that I thought might have been recent, or I don't know.
It's all original footage. It's all archival footage, and there's a lot of people that contributed, but the more unrecognizable stuff, I mean, if you don't know G.B. Jones's art or her films, a lot of it comes from G.B. Jones's films, but then the band worked with John Porter, who's also a Toronto-based Super 8 filmmaker, experimental filmmaker, and performance artist, and he was doing stuff at this place called The Funnel at the time, which was an experimental, a place where kids were making
gallery
movies, yeah, and it was a gallery, and they'd show their movies and stuff, so the band worked with him to shoot these moving, this wallpaper, so it's like filmic wallpaper, and they would project them live, which is funny, because that's something you see bands do now all of the time.
Right.
You know, like, you rarely go to a show or to a dance party where they don't have this video component, and so Fifth Column would take these images and just sort of loop them, play them continuously for each song, a thematic visual. So that's pretty interesting to think about.
When I was about 10, 12 years ago, I lived in Tokyo at the time, and in my neighbor's Harajuku, I walked down the street one day, turned the corner, and there were 30-foot high picture banners hanging from a department store with women in leather jackets on bikes, muscular, tough. And I said, it can't be. This is in Tokyo. Could this be G.B. Jones? I went in and actually talked to them, and it was.
Oh, my God.
So it's very funny. This band that I remember as being like 2-inch-high photocopied pencil drawings,
yeah,
in a zine, which I suddenly saw, you know, 30, 40 foot high in downtown Tokyo. So,
oh my God, I want one of those.
maybe you could ask G.B. Jones if she got him back. I'm not sure, but
no.
I mean, isn't that, to me, that's sort of like a metaphor for the band itself, where it operated on a very tiny scale, but their influence spread exponentially all around the world.
Yeah, that's beautiful to think about. I had no idea, actually. So what was it? It was like a retrospective drawing?
Some of that, yeah. They even gave me a pair of G.B. Jones cartoon socks.
Oh, my God. I want those. I can't believe it. They're, you know, my apartment was filled with boxes and boxes and boxes and boxes of archival stuff, like films that had been in people's basements and zines that I'd only heard, like, tell of, and, you know, just endless amounts of archival stuff. And it's hilarious that they're still... It's the tip of the iceberg, like, just hearing stories like that. Even working so closely with the band, like, okay, apparently there's 30-foot banners also that I didn't know about. It's just insane.
And, like, how did La Tigra find out about them?
Well, I mean, Kathleen Hanna was, like, a teenage girl, and she was sort of getting into the sort of feminist poetry scene. And oh my God, who told her about it now? I can't remember.
But she appears in
Donna
Dresch
or someone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was Donna Dresch. Oh, that might be really wildly inaccurate. I can't remember now. But she basically, through a friend of a friend, got the zine Double Bill, which GB and Jenna von Brucker and all these, and Carolyn Azar and all these people contributed to. and it was about William Burroughs and William Conrad, and sort of juxtaposing this really friendly television character and then this punk rock icon who is this sort of misogynist hero for, you know, gay men. And it basically blew her mind, and she got into GB's films and became this huge, huge fan of G.B. Jones, and then later Fifth Column. And actually, she started making her Riot Girl zines because of the influence and impact that Double Bill had on her life. And so Riot Girl and Bikini Kill, the band, was actually all kind of inspired by her being exposed to this Fifth Column related work.
Just to talk briefly about the politics, where did the name come from? What's the meaning of their name?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of talk around that, but essentially the idea is to infiltrate. A fifth columnist is someone who sort of infiltrates a larger body from within, you know, and they corrupt it from within.
Subversive element.
Yeah, and so they insert these sort of subversive elements into a culture to try and corrupt it with their own politics and ideas.
And they're a self-described a feminist band, but what did that mean? How can a band be subversive?
That was actually the hardest thing. You mean feminists?
Yeah.
That was one of the hardest things to sort of articulate in the movie, because it just means, and Beverly Breckenridge says straight up in the movie, like, that you can't really talk about that because it means so many things. And, but the idea, I mean, I find it hard to speak to because, you know, I'm like a gay, white male and everything, and I can only speak from my own perspective. But obviously, the simple act of being women that were doing something together in a band was met with a lot of adversity and aggression from people in the punk rock community or even just in the media. And they sort of had to align themselves with this idea of being a feminist, which was just like this, it seemed like an expletive or something, you know? Like, why? I don't know. Obviously, it's not like they were preaching in their music, like, destroy men or anything like that. And it's just a term, I think, that got applied to them. And, of course, they're going to stand by the fact that they're feminists. It just means that they're capable of independence and control of their work and their bodies, I guess.
And finally, you don't deal with it in the movie, but did they ever talk about why the band broke up? Why they stopped performing, why they broke up? I mean, there certainly was animosity between individual members.
Well, I mean, there was animosity between members that came and went and everything, but the core of the band, G.B. Jones, Carolyn Azar, and Beverly Breckenridge are very close. And it was, I think, just a matter of people moving on in their lives and not intending to break up. Like, I don't think the band actually broke up. I think the scenario just changed, and
right.
It was never really defined what that was, which I think is nice. That's why the movie doesn't focus on that. It's not the exciting part of the story as far as I'm concerned.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Thanks, Daniel.
I've been speaking with Kevin Hagee about his new documentary, She Said Boom, the story of the Fifth Column, which is playing Sunday night at 5 p.m. at the Inside Out Festival. This is Daniel Garber for CIUT 89.5 FM and CulturalMining.com.